He let a moment pass in deliberate emphasis, then answered, "My two best friends. You know one of them. You know perhaps better than anyone else what price he paid for it. Our own teacher, Dr. Axton, was next. He joined us within one evening's conversation. William Hastings, who had been my boss in the research laboratory of 20th Century Motors, had a hard time fighting it out with himself. It took him a year, but he joined. Then Richard Halley, then Midas Mulligan. Who took 15 minutes, said Mulligan. She turned to him.
It was you who established this valley?
Yes, said Mulligan. It was just my own private retreat at first. I bought it years ago. I bought miles of these mountains, section by section, from ranchers and cattlemen who didn't know what they owned. The valley is not listed on any map. I built this house when I decided to quit. I cut off all possible avenues of approach except one road, and it's camouflage beyond anyone's power to discover. And I stocked this place to be self-supporting so that I could live here for the rest of my life and never have to see the face of a looter. When I heard that John had got Judge Narragansett, too, I invited the judge to come here. Then we asked Richard Halley to join us. The others remained outside at first.
We had no rules of any kind, said Galt, except one. When a man took our oath, it meant a single commitment, not to work in his own profession, not to give to the world the benefit of his mind. Each of us carried it out in any manner he chose. Those who had money retired to live on their savings. Those who had to work took the lowest jobs they could find. Some of us had been famous. Others, like that young brakeman of yours whom Halley discovered, were stopped by us before they had set out to get tortured. But we did not give up our minds or the work we loved. Each of us continued in his real profession in whatever manner and spare time he could manage, but he did it secretly for his own sole benefit, giving nothing to men, sharing nothing. We were scattered all over the country, as the outcasts we had always been. Only now we accepted our parts with conscious intention. Our sole relief were the rare occasions when we could see one another. We found that we liked to meet, in order to be reminded that human beings still existed. So we came to set aside 1 month a year to spend in this valley, to rest, to live in a rational world, to bring our real work out of hiding, to trade our achievements. Here, where achievements meant payment, not expropriation. Each of us built his own house here at his own expense for 1 month of life out of 12. It made the 11 easier to bear.
You see, Miss Taggart, said Hugh Axton, man is a social being, but not in the way the looters preach.
It's the destruction of Colorado that started the growth of this valley, said Midas Mulligan. Ellis White and the others came to live here permanently because they had to hide. Whatever part of their wealth they could salvage, they converted into gold or machines, as I had, and they brought it here. There were enough of us to develop the place and to create jobs for those who had had to earn their living outside. We have now reached the stage where most of us can live here full-time. The valley is almost self-supporting. And as to the goods that we can't yet produce, I purchased them from the outside through a pipeline of my own. It's a special agent, a man who does not let my money reach the looters. We are not a state here, not a society of any kind. We're just a voluntary association of men held together by nothing but every man's self-interest. I own the valley, and I sell the land to the others when they want it. Judge Narragansett is to act as our arbiter in case of disagreements. He hasn't had to be called upon as yet. They say that it's hard for men to agree. You'd be surprised how easy it is when both parties hold as their moral absolute that neither exists for the sake of the other, and that reason is their only means of trade. The time is approaching when all of us will have to be called to live here, because the world is falling apart so fast that it will soon be starving. But we will be able to support ourselves in this valley.
The world is crashing faster than we expected, said Hugh Axton. Men are stopping and giving up. Your frozen trains, the gangs of raiders, the deserters, they're men who've never heard of us, and they're not part of our strike. They are acting on their own. It's the natural response of whatever rationality is still left in them. It's the same kind of protest as ours.
We started with no time limit in view, said Galt. We did not know whether we'd live to see the liberation of the world, or whether we'd have to leave our battle and our secret to the next generations. We knew only that this was the only way we cared to live. But now we think that we will see, and soon, the day of our victory and of our return.
When? She whispered.
When the code of the looters has collapsed. He saw her looking at him, her glance half question, half hope, and he added, when the creed of self-immolation has run for once its undisguised course, when men find no victims ready to obstruct the path of justice and to deflect the fall of retribution on themselves, when the preachers of self-sacrifice discover that those who are willing to practice it have nothing to sacrifice, and those who have are not willing any longer, when men see that neither their hearts nor their muscles can save them, but the mind they damned is not there to answer their screams for help, when they collapse, as they must, as men without mind, when they have no pretense of authority left, no remnant of law, no trace of morality, no hope, no food, and no way to obtain it, when they collapse and the road is clear, then we'll come back to rebuild the world. The Taggart Terminal, she thought. She heard the words beating through the numbness of her mind as the sum of a burden she had not had time to weigh. This was the Taggart Terminal, she thought. This room, not the giant concourse in New York. This was her goal, the end of track, the point beyond the curve of the earth where the two straight lines of rail met and vanished, drawing her forward, as they had drawn Nathaniel Taggart. This was the goal Nathaniel Taggart had seen in the distance, and this was the point, still holding the straight-line glance of his lifted head above the spiral motion of men in the granite concourse. It was for the sake of this that she had dedicated herself to the rail of Taggart Transcontinental, as to the body of a spirit yet to be found. She had found it. Everything she had ever wanted, it was here in this room, reached, and hers. But the price was that net of rail behind her, the rail that would vanish, the bridges that would crumble, the signal lights that would go out. And yet, everything I had ever wanted, she thought, looking away from the figure of a man with sun-colored hair and implacable eyes.
You don't have to answer us now.
She raised her head. He was watching her as if he had followed the steps in her mind.
We never demand agreement, he said. We never tell anyone more than he is ready to hear. You were the first person who has learned our secret ahead of time. But you're here, and you had to know. Now you know the exact nature of the choice you'll have to make. If it seems hard, it's because you still think that it does not have to be one or the other. You will learn that it does.
Will you give me time?
Your time is not ours to give. Take your time. You alone can decide what you'll choose to do and when. We know the cost of that decision. We've paid it. That you've come here might now make it easier for you. Or harder.
Harder, she whispered.
I know.
He said it, his voice as low as hers, with the same sound of being forced past one's breath. And she missed an instant of time, as in the stillness after a blow, because she felt that this, not the moments when he had carried her in his arms down the mountainside, but this meeting of their voices, had been the closest physical contact between them. A full moon stood in the sky above the valley when they drove back to his house. It stood like a flat, round lantern without rays, with a haze of light hanging in space, not reaching the ground, and the illumination seemed to come from the abnormal white brightness of the soil. In the unnatural stillness of sight, without color, the earth seemed veiled by a film of distance. Its shapes did not merge into a landscape, but went slowly flowing past, like the print of a photograph on a cloud. She noticed suddenly that she was smiling. She was looking down at the houses of the valley. Their lighted windows were dimmed by a bluish cast. The outlines of their walls were dissolving. Long bands of mist were coiling among them in torpid, unhurried waves. It looked like a city sinking under water. "What do they call this place?" she asked.
"I call it Mulligan's Valley," he said. "The others call it Galt's Gulch."
"I'd call it..." But she did not finish. He glanced at her. She knew what he saw in her face. He turned away. She saw a faint movement of his lips like the release of a breath that he was forcing to function. She dropped her glance, her arm falling against the side of the car, as if her hand were suddenly too heavy for the weakness in the crook of her elbow. The road grew darker as it went higher, and pine branches met over their heads. Above a slant of rock moving to meet them, she saw the moonlight on the windows of his house. Her head fell back against the seat, and she lay still, losing awareness of the car, feeling only the motion that carried her forward, watching the glittering drops of water in the pine branches, which were the stars. when the car stopped. She did not permit herself to know why she did not look at him as she stepped out. She did not know that she stood still for an instant, looking up at the dark windows. She did not hear him approach, but she felt the impact of his hands with shocking intensity, as if it were the only awareness she could now experience. He lifted her in his arms and started slowly up the path to the house.